Okay, another Wednesday night, and we're in the middle of Matthew chapter 5 and the Sermon on the Mount. And in spite of what we may have said at the end of last week's program, we're going to rehash verses 31 and 32 here. But before we do, it's, I think, important to notice that Christ is saying this within the context of verses 27 through 30. That you have heard it has been said, you shall not commit adultery, and anyone who beholds a woman. Now, that term for woman there is the Greek word gune, and it was typically used of married women. A woman who was a virgin was a maiden, and as we might translate it in English, and was expected, a maiden at one time in the English language was expected to be a virgin. An unmarried woman was expected to be a virgin. So the Greek word parthenos means virgin, and it's distinguished from gune, which is the term by which a married woman or a woman who's had husbands in the past would be called. So that's the Greek word gune. So it's speaking about married women, and then Christ says, if your right eye entraps you, take it out and cast it away from you, because you shouldn't be looking with lustful thoughts after a married woman. So that's the context that sets the stage for his remarks here in verses 31 and 32 about a bill of divorce. And I'll let Franklin read them before we discuss them further. Or Jackson.
Starting at verse 31. Verse 31, and it has been said, he who would put away his wife must give her a bill of divorce. To you, that each who puts his wife away, except for reason of fornication, makes her to commit adultery, and he who would marry a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it has been said to the ancients, you shall not swear falsely, and you shall make atonement for your oaths to Yahweh. Now I say to you, not to swear at all. Not by the heaven, because it is the throne of Yahweh, nor by the earth, because it is a footstool for his feet, nor upon Jerusalem, because it is the city of the great king. Nor should you swear by your head, because you are not able to make one hair white or black. Now your word must be yeah, yeah, no, no. And what is excess of these is from of evil. You have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Now I say to you, not to oppose evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn for him also the other. And to him desiring for you, also go to ask you, and you should not go away from him wishing to borrow from you. You have heard that you shall love him to you, and you shall hate your enemy. Now I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those persecuting you, that you may be sons of your Father who is in the heavens, because his Son rises upon evil and good and rains upon righteousness and unrighteousness. For if you should love those loving you, what reward do you have? Do not also the tax collectors do the same? And if you should greet your brethren only, what do you do that is extraordinary? Do not also the heathens do the same? Therefore, you shall be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. End of chapter 5.
Okay, I don't know if anybody else wants to speak first. That's fine. If anybody else has some thoughts.
The only thing I have to say is, Jackson, your connection kind of sucks, but good job. Cut out for a while.
I didn't know if it was his connection or mine, so I didn't say a word about it.
Go on, guys.
No, I have horrible connection at my house. I don't have Wi-Fi. I'm just working off a cell signal.
It's about my predicament. It has been said to her, it has been said, he who should put away his wife must give her to her a bill of divorce. In Rome and Judea at this time is under Roman rule. And there were very strict divorce laws. and there had to be cause for divorce. And there were very strict property laws in the case of divorce, where a husband had to hold a dowry that was given to him by his bride's father, and he was expected to pay back a certain amount of that dowry to his soon-to-be former wife in the process of a divorce, so that she could support herself at least for some time after the divorce was made. A lot of the decision, though, as to whether or not she received any dowry would have been determined according to whose fault the divorce was. They didn't have no-fault divorce in ancient Rome. So it was a legal process that was more involved than the ancient Israelites and the fact that they could just write their wife a bill of divorce and send them out the door. So we're not in an Old Testament context here. We're in a slightly different context. But even with that, where it says right after Christ speaks of divorce, again, you have heard that it has been said to the ancients, you shall not swear falsely, and you shall make atonement for your oaths to Yahweh. Well, every marriage arrangement is basically a covenant between a man and his father-in-law. Not a man and his wife, a man and his father-in-law. And a man makes promises, and the father-in-law has an expectation that he will fulfill those promises and take care of the daughter that he's giving away to this man. So that's an oath. So this is all interconnected, right? Christ isn't just flippantly changing the subject. It's all interconnected subjects. And that's the way it should be seen. So you're basically breaking those oaths to father-in-law when you divorce your wife, unless she's clearly at fault, like for fornication, which is what Christ says here, that fornication is a valid reason for divorce. Now, fornication is not only race mixing. Race mixing is one form of fornication. And fornication is any sort of illicit sexual acts. So a wife committing adultery, where she goes and sleeps with another man, that's fornication. That's an illicit sexual act. So that's grounds for divorce. But according to Christ here, that's the only grounds for divorce. The only valid grounds for divorce is what we call cheating or adultery, or which is a form of fornication. So if you put your wife away, unless you have valid reason, you're making her commit adultery, because she has to be driven into the arms of another man. That's her only way to survive in the ancient world, unless she had her own estate, which was like one woman in thousands may have had their own estate, her own portion of an estate, or her own inheritance from a father or an uncle. The Greeks, in the Greek world, the sons always got all of the inheritance. And a woman can only inherit under Athenian law from an uncle. She couldn't even inherit anything from her father.
And actually,
brothers, they got it. If she had uncles, they got it.
Bill, if I might say, so it was not only just the sons, but it was the oldest son only, right? That
typically,
got the
it was the old that got at least most of the estate. Yes.
And even in the Middle Ages,
which is why emperors adopted their heir.
Right, because they thought that he was a more suitable man to run things, right?
Yes, very often. So yeah. They would adopt their heir and leave it to him. So it didn't, by law, it did not have to be the old son in Roman law.
Right. But do you think that that's more fair? I mean, actually, your opinion and my opinion doesn't really matter on the subject, but you know how Yahweh works is he says it's the oldest son unless he screws up. unless he really screws up like Ruben. And
well, I do think it's fair. I don't have anything to lead to any of my sons. I got five living sons, and none of them are getting squat.
Right, but I mean, like, as a group, people historically, what do you think?
I think that man has an expectation that his kids are going to honor and obey him, and if they don't honor and obey him, he has every right to go adopt an heir that will honor and obey him.
Right, and what you're saying is true of Reuben and Simeon, although he didn't have to adopt kids because he had other sons, but they were cast out from the roles that they should have inherited. I mean,
right, Jacob cut him off. He didn't leave him much at all. He didn't leave him anything.
Right, and it's fair. It is fair because it's Yahweh's law. It's not man's law because as us, we would be like kind of soft on the issue and be like, okay, the oldest guy's got to get it, even though he fucked up. But, you know, it doesn't work.
I've seen lots of parents leave their estates to totally useless kids. But they have no conviction themselves. If you have no conviction yourself, what do you care? You leave it to anyone. It don't matter. After you're dead, it's gone. Now I say to you not to swear at all, not by the heaven, because it is the throne of Yahweh, nor by the earth, that the ancient Israelites were consistently making false oaths and invoking the name of Yahweh in those false oaths, but also at the time of Christ, and he chastised them several times for this, that the Pharisees would swear by the altar or swear by the temple, and they'd always be making false oaths because men shouldn't swear because we really can't see the future and we really don't know if we're going to be able to uphold our promises.
Right.
That reminds me of a part in Nehemiah where these people are making an oath and Nehemiah writes down that they brought a curse upon themselves. And I found that really interesting.
Right, because they're swearing to something that they cannot control.
Yeah.
If you look at the Hebrew word for oath and the Hebrew word for curse, that they're either very similar or perhaps they're the same word. It's been a while. Curses Arar, number 779.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong on the matter, but, you know, swearing in general, like taking an oath, it's sort of a bit of humanism, right? Because you're saying that I'm so valuable, that I will swear to not break this oath. I mean, in the ancient world, it was different, right? These days, you know, and I mean something like for the moment. But like in the
even today, when somebody says a cuss word, people will say stop swearing. Even today, the two ideas are confused, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's why we say Yahweh willing, David, and like I think that's why James talks about it in his epistle. Like we're just vapors of smoke. We can't say, "Oh, tomorrow I'm going to do this or that." We say, "If Yahweh wills, tomorrow we're going to do this or that."
Yeah, good point. You know, sometimes I'll make an oath, meaning like I'll swear on something or I'll really mean to plead it, right? But I don't feel bad for doing that.
You know, I think life is a lot simpler if you just don't make oaths.
The thing is, yeah, but the thing is, okay, so these days there aren't many consequences, right? And the only thing are more consequences. So I guess that's why I do it. I don't know. I guess that's why people do it.
I think it's a bad habit, like, because you sort of grow up with it. Like, oh, I swear I'll do it, or I swear I didn't do that, or whatever.
It's sad, ultimately.
Okay, curse is an ara, and an oath is an Allah, so they're not as close as I thought, but they're still kind of close.
Are you talking about the moon god? Kidding. Did all of us... Pardon me.
To interject, what should we take away from the section where Christ speaks not to oppose evil?
That evil is not like evil as in the eyes of something we should rebuke, but evil as in a wrong being done to you, I think, right? Because vengeance is God's. But we should certainly like rebuke people. I think it's different.
You shall love him to you, and you shall hate your enemy. Now I said you love your enemies and pray for those killing you, that you may be sons of your Father who is in the heavens, because his sun rises upon the evil and good and rains upon the righteous and the unrighteous. It's a real challenge, but he's not really talking about these other races or these enemies of God. He's speaking to Israelites for and about Israelites, whether they're pagans or Christians doesn't really matter. I don't think he's speaking to the other races.
Well, Franklin was talking about the oppose evil phrase.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
But he spoke in parables just so the other races can even understand him.
Right.
Well, we have a collective right to defend ourselves, and even Christ told the apostles, two swords, it is sufficient. Dad, you better put your cloak and buy a sword. So you have a collective right to defend yourself, but you shouldn't go, if a brother does you wrong, you have to let that go. That you can't oppose. You have to let it go.
It's sort of like Paul. He was wronged by those coppersmiths and silversmiths, and he writes to Timothy, like, Yahweh will judge them according to their works.
Right.
But he doesn't write to Timothy like, oh, I'm going to get him one day or something.
So is that to no exception, no matter what the wrong was?
Well, I mean, I don't see any exceptions in the text.
Okay, Bill, so in verse 38, the turning of the cheek. So there was a guy, I can't remember his name, brought up on the forum, I think, that the turning of a cheek was a historic thing, and that you know, if a man slaps you on the right of your cheek, then you turn your face to the right, because he can't slap you without being a fool, right? I think that you perhaps you want to comment on it. I think that you said yeah, that kind of makes sense. Is this,
it's been so long since I've even thought of that subject that I really don't have a comment on it.
Okay, but I mean, think about it, right? Like, let's say I slap you in the face, right? I slap you from my right hand because I'm right-handed. And then you turn your cheek to the right. And then if I slap you, it doesn't make sense, right? I have to slap you with my left hand, which was an insult, a severe insult in the ancient world.
It was a severe insult to be slapped with, like, a left hand?
So well, no, it's just, you're taking away his ability to do so. Do you remember that? Do you remember that, Bill? There was a guy on the forum that brought it up. I can't remember his name. Sorry, but he was saying something about the ancient world, and you take away his power by turning your cheek, and that it's
So you're saying they essentially defend their other cheek?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Because the person would have to use the same hand twice in a row, they would look pretty silly.
Yeah, and actually, then it's not really a slap, then it's a punch, which is a little bit different. I mean, these days we just say punch, right? If you hit somebody in the face, it's a punch. But in those days, everything was more figurative. Do you remember? Do you recall that?
No, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't.
But what do you think of the?
I was actually searching the forum and can't find it, or I can't find anything like it.
Right? You know what? I don't think it was a post, though.
Short threads.
Yeah, it wasn't like an original post. It was like a someone who commented on a subject. And again, I don't remember his name.
I mean, it could just be letting wicked people identify themselves to everybody around.
Wasn't there a part where he told them to go out and preach the gospel, and if they slapped him, turn the other cheek and keep preaching? Is there a part of that?
No. No, I don't remember that.
No.
It's basically the same as not opposing evil from your brethren. If you're Christian and your brother is oppressing you, it should be... I mean, I know it's difficult, but the attitude should be, well, take what you want. But Yahweh's going to judge you for that.
But I mean, like, in the sense of the historical world, the where it was in the ancient history, that it may have had a different meaning. I don't doubt what you're saying. I think it makes sense, of course. God,
you know, I don't think so, because it's within the context. And to him desiring for you to be judged and to receive your cloak, give up to him also the shirt. That means that individual had a claim against you in the first place. So somebody would only slap you if you had wronged them. And he's telling you that if you've wronged them, not to resist them.
Okay.
Now I say to you, not to oppose evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn for him also the other. And to him desiring for you to be judged and to receive your cloak. Why would that happen? Because perhaps you killed his cow or something. And now he wants to punish you. He wants justice for your having harmed him. That's the only way that someone would desire for you to be judged and to receive your cloak. Back then, in the ancient world, it was a big thing for a man with no means to even have a cloak. Might be the most valuable thing he has. So give up to him also the shirt. So that's somebody that you have wronged. Otherwise, he wouldn't be desiring for you to be judged, right?
Right.
So if you're being slapped and you didn't do anything wrong, you oppose it?
No, you shouldn't oppose him, because if
his vengeance is God's, right?
He also offer the other.
Yeah.
So this is a tricky scenario, which non-Christians, antichrists, tend to beat on, if I can say that.
Yes, and I understand that, but they don't understand Christianity in the first place, so they're going to find experts to pick on. But if you slap me in the face, I'm just going to say, what the fuck did you do that for?
Right, and that's... And what you said earlier, it's about what did you do, right? Because
verse 38 kind of show that it looks like that you did something to get slapped? Like, that's why it says an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. you did something to get slapped.
Right. I agree. Yeah. And then you should take it, right? Like, not be like all pissed off about it.
Well, you know what? If you harm me in any way and you were seeking, you say, Bill, I'm sorry, I fucked up. I want to make amends for that. How could I atone for that? Then I'm going to be more forgiving. And there's no way I'm going to slap you. And that's how Christians should act.
No, but the thing is, so we've discussed the actual meaning. However, you know, these antichrists, they'll basically harp on the fact that we just have to get beat up all the time, right? They think of Christianity as a wimpy religion, right? So, yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Right,
I
mean, but that's fine. This is talking about our personal enemies. It's not talking about God's enemies.
Right, but they can't see that. They don't realize.
He warned all the time about the wolves among the sheep, the wolves in sheep's clothing, and many similar sayings and statements. It's they're not the people that he's talking about. Those people should not be in Christian communion in the first place.
Yeah,
this is instructions to people who are living in an evil pagan world. And the Israelites in Judea were outnumbered by the enemies.
Yeah, they're basically autistic.
And he's
right,
basically
though?
Telling them how they should treat each other.
Am I wrong in saying that? Like they
take shouldn't be having interactions with the Edomites or the heathens.
But they take a verse out of context, which they often do, which of course, but this is one of their favorites because they don't want to do the research.
This is the attitude we need to have in a high trust society. You need to be able to overlook these things because we don't want a dog-eat-dog society like the non-whites. And in Leviticus, it even says, do not hold a grudge nor avenge against the children of thy people.
Yeah. Absolutely, Joe. That's good.
Because we need that sort of society.
Yes, we do. Because otherwise, we descend into the same society as the non-whites.
So it's got nothing to do with like being pansies or whatever. This is what we need to form a bond that's a really strong bond so that we can overcome the world, I think. So it's nothing weak. It's actually like if you're in the army, do you think your general's going to allow the men to do tit-for-tat bullcrap while you're fighting a war? He's going to say, forget all that bullcrap and do what I'm telling you to do right now, you know? And Christ is our general, isn't he?
Yeah.
So if he tells us to not do something, just don't do it and just keep your eyes on the mission.
Right. And even we see that in our regular lives, right? Because every now and then there's like, you know, many things happening. Right, it happens sometimes, right? There's many things happening, and you have to focus on what is the ultimate goal, right?
Yeah.
Well, in the very next verse, and the chapter border is artificial, and in the very next verse, he's thinking about charity and mercy. And you wouldn't give charity and mercy to the non-white races or to the enemies of God. So if verses 1 through 4 do not pertain to them, that then verses 43 through 48 of this chapter do not pertain to them, that this is speaking about our relationships with ourselves, that this is speaking to his followers, to his sheep, and how they should treat one another.
Yeah, and 47 in specific, I think. What do you do that is extraordinary?
Do not also the heathens do the same.
Yeah, and you know what, Bill?
Distinguishing the heathens, right? He's the nations, right? The pagan nations. He's distinguishing them.
Right, and that's one thing that's always pissed me off. I mean, since I became CI like 5-6 years ago, that you know, if I'm only good to them, like my parents or my sisters, my niece and nephew and so forth, then what am I really doing, right? So I feel like I have to be good to other white people in society, even though I think most of them, well, I know most of them are just fucked up. They don't know anything.
You know what's extraordinary about CI? Is the racism. Is the brotherly love. We reserve our kindness for our own kind. That's extraordinary in a world like this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, no matter how lost they are, I still feel more comfortable around them, right? Like white people.
Yeah, definitely. Unless they're doing like race mixing or they're thieves or really right. bad drug addicts or something, then you feel uncomfortable. But if it's just normal, regular white folk, I think we should feel comfortable about them. We shouldn't like cut ourselves off or make ourselves unavailable to other white folk, your fellow countrymen. If he's just a good, hardworking guy, he hasn't heard CI, and you just help that guy out and talk to him like he's a bro, I mean, one day you might be having a chat about CI, and that's how you can witness to him. Just say, hey, I'm a regular guy just like you, and this is our God.
You know, we do that all the time, and that's the attitude I always take into the community with me when I venture into the street. It's good to set that example before other people so that they could see how you act. And then when they hear what you're about, they can't be offended.
Gee, Bill's a Nazi? He seems like a good bloke to me. I know, yeah. Bill, and you're telling me he's a Nazi? Well, the Nazis must be pretty good guys.
Yeah, but that's the way it works, right?
If you talk to Melissa, you know, when we moved here, word went around the neighborhood pretty quick about me, and everybody hated me and nobody wanted to talk to us. And I told Melissa for years, just smile and wave. Every time you pass them, smile and wave.
Wow. And it worked, Bill?
It's worked to a great extent, yeah. There's a lot of them that will wave back now.
Yeah.
I got people at work, Roman saluting me.
Hold it. No. The other night we were in a,
Why are you getting fired soon?
Start we going. Were in a brew pub, a big brew pub up in Freeport, staying away from the beach, right? From spring break. We don't want to go near the beach. Freeport is in the backwoods in Florida. Well, Melissa had an 80-something-year-old man and a bartender woman that was probably about 45. She had him Sig Heiling in the freaking bar.
Yeah, you know, I've seen that too here where I live, which is, you know, quite a bit south of you. And I mean, I can use the word sand nigger for like an Arab randomly, and people are okay with it.
Yeah. Well, Melissa had this barmaid and this old man that was talking to us. She had him Sig Heiling. She was talking about German pride and had him Sig Heiling in the bar.
Yeah, everybody feels like they have to shut the fuck up, but really, it's okay, right? I mean, we're all together and alone. Imagine that. Funny.
So I the old man had a younger guy with him, and I gave him a card. If they hate me, they hate me. I don't care. They can't say anything bad about us.
Yeah, and probably in private quarters, they say good things about you. But. Guessing.
It was pretty funny to have the girl behind the bar going Sig Heil and talking about German pride.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you set a good example and you're kind to people, what could they say bad about you? Nothing. If they do, then who's being unrighteous? Right. They are.
Yeah. And they know it.
Themselves.
We know it too, right? Like when we do that, because we'll do that too. We're all vulnerable to that. You don't feel right when you do that. I think.
So I believe these verses are all about how we treat each other. He's distinguishing the heathens, right? Which I take that word that means nations, and sometimes it should be translated as heathens, meaning those of the white nations who are just pagans, who are just that they're not Christians, right? Even if they might be Christians one day, they're not Christians now. They're living as pagans. So I think that it's appropriate in certain contexts to do that. And that also seems to be the general use of the time anyway, where the Greeks would say barbarous or barbarians.
Hey, Bill, so verse 42, give to him asking you, and you should not turn away from him wishing to borrow from you. What do you think of that? Like, we're not talking about just Christian people, right? It's just our brethren in general. You think?
Yeah, because you want to set a good example for them and win them over to Christianity.
Yeah, and it kind of implies that if you have a few bucks, you know, extra, and it's just sitting around, you might as well give it to some guy. And if you don't get it back, who cares?
Right. Right. I would agree with that.
And verse 45 is kind of cool too, because he's going to make the sun rise on the evil. So that's kind of, you know, sums up why we don't need to take revenge. He's going to do it.
Yes. That's fine. So I think the context of these chapters is very important to understand all of this. And you can't imagine that he's speaking about niggers in Africa. He's speaking to ye who are the light of the world. And this is all interconnected, this entire thread. It's not just random thoughts.
Are you sure?
And as Joe said, and Joe made a very good cross-reference with Leviticus chapter 19, and as he said, Christ isn't really teaching anything new. It's already in the law, but it wasn't being taught by the Pharisees.
Really? Because I thought he just walked around saying stupid shit like every now and then.
Because it sounded cool.
Blunt.
That's how mainstream Christians teach teach the gospel. He was just saying cool stuff.
Yeah. I think the coolest guy ever. Sorry, go on, Joe.
He was a hippie after all. He had long hair and wore sandals. That proves it.
I do too. Can I try?
Was Joe going to say anything?
No, he meant you, Bill. I can say something, though. You know, Christ is reestablishing the racial lines here to treat your brother according to the law. He's not teaching some sort of universalism thing. He's reestablishing the racial lines because he's telling them, you know, these are your brothers right here. This is how you should treat these people. Forget about the Pharisees, you know, Sadducees. Some of the Pharisees were white. But forget about those people. And, treat your brother, you know, he's reestablishing these racial lines that were in the Old Testament.
Well, he's going to get into the hypocrites several times at the beginning of chapter 6. And once again, that's all interconnected with this discussion. It's all the same discussion. The chapter divisions are unfortunate. They sort of encourage people to forget what was just said 5 verses ago because it was in a different chapter.
Even in the same paragraph, they'll want you to forget the opening to the beginning of the paragraph because that might establish the context, and they want to set a new context, so you have to forget that.
Right, I've seen that all the time.
Especially with the judgment of nations is one example I can think of. Like it says, you know, when the Son of Man shall return, he shall set divide by nations and set the sheep nations on his right hand and the goat nations on his left. So they forget that bit and then go into the next bit where it says something about fruits. You know, if you do good, you know, but it's talking about the fruits of the nations and how those nations behave. But they want to forget the context and make it about individuals. So they have to forget that first opening to the passage where he sets the context. They forget that and then just go into some bullcrap about personal salvation because I can't have that.
All the time. They do it all the time.
Yeah. Even half of us, they'll cut out the first half of it because it sets the context and just focus on the next sentence or that word right there.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's funny.
That's the super Lutheran approach to scripture.
It is.
Yeah, but he knows better, so.
Yeah, here's a piece of paper to prove it. Well, we can get into chapter 6.
I just have a comment, sort of off topic, but in verse 35, the earth is called the footstool for his feet, and that makes me think of Psalm 110, where Yahweh is depicted as saying to the Messiah, you know, stay at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And it's sort of like until I make them. So it's like between the first and the second advents. So it's sort of like maybe until your enemies cover the entire earth and you can come and tread that winepress.
Right.
Which verse you're referring to, Noble? The footstool.
35, and then Psalm 110.
Oh, I see. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so it's sort of like the enemies covering the entire earth. Which they have.
Well, back then, I mean, you could look at, even if you look at Earth as land, that they do cover that entire land. And far beyond it. So, how many white people, white men and women, do you think at any given time are in Mesopotamia and Levant?
Maybe like 20 tourists.
Yeah.
Well, now probably much military less
personnel. And
yeah. But before, they weren't in Europe or anything. Like, Europe wasn't, there was really not many people there at all. Now they're everywhere. They're in UK, they're in Scandinavia, they're in Greenland. They're, like, everywhere.
Yeah, it's horrible. They're in Ukraine and Russia. African niggers are in Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah. I remember when I was backpacking in Norway, I was in Finnmark, which is the northernmost province of Norway, and there was a nigger there getting gas. I was like...
Yeah, they're getting the flood too. Right. Go east. In,
we can likely move on, though.
Yeah.
So start chapter 6?
Yeah.
Chapter 6. Now offer your righteousness, not to do before men, from them to behold, yet otherwise you have no reward from your Father who is in the heavens. Therefore, when you should do an act of charity, you should not trumpet it before you, even as the hypocrites do in the assembly halls and in the streets, that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they received their reward, but upon your doing an act of charity, your left hand must not know what your right hand does, that your act of charity would be in secret, and your Father who sees would repay you in secret. And when you pray, do not be as the hypocrites, because they love to pray in the assembly halls and standing at the corners of the streets, that they should be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you would pray, go into your closet, and closing your door, you shall pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees shall yield to you in secret. And those praying should not babble on repeatedly, just as the heathen, for they suppose that by their many words they shall be heard. Therefore, do not become like them, for your Father knows that which of you have needed of before you ask him. Therefore, thusly are you to pray: O Father who is in the heavens, your name must be sanctified, your kingdom must come, your will must be done, as in heaven, also upon the earth. Get to us our sufficient for today, and remit us of our debts, as we also have remitted for our debtors. And do not bring us into trial, but deliver us from the evil one.
Here you go, right at the end. Give to us our debts, remit for us our debts, as we have also remitted for our debtors. And you tie that right back to those verses at the end of chapter 5 about forgiving people that need things from you.
I think you mistranslated the last verse, Bill. It says evil one. It's supposed to say evil. You know, who's the evil one? There's no evil one. It's just evil, you know. Right. My whatever I feel is evil.
It's a substantive.
But yeah, I know.
I know you're joking.
Yeah, I'm joking.
You know, pick
on Bill.
That's the no devil, the devil deniers. It's to poneru. Deliver us from evil. No, it's actually a genitive masculine definite article with a noun. So you could say deliver us from the evil.
Oh.
Or you could really understand what he's talking about and how he uses the word in many other places, and it's a physical entity that we need to be delivered from.
Regardless, it's not, in this case, it wouldn't be the evil that's perceived by men, like the trials they go through for their sins and things like that.
Right.
In this case, it's an entity that we need to be delivered from, that we need to be delivered from the devices of the enemy.
And we can't deliver ourselves. We have no hope without Christ. Like none, zero.
Well, the same phrase, the same exact phrase appears in Luke 6:45, which is also Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount. And it says, a good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good. And that's how the King James Version translated that. And a good man, the word man is not found in the verse at all. There's no word for man in the whole verse. It's to agathu, which is the same masculine genitive form as we see in Tuponeru here, and further on in Luke 6:45. So a good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good, and that's to agathu. And they translated it a good man because they understood that he wasn't talking about good as a concept. He was talking about a good person because it appears with the definite article, and it's a substantive, a good man. And then it says, and the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil, for his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. So where it says, and the evil man, it's hoponeros because it's nominative, it's not genitive, but it's still a masculine definite article with a masculine form of the adjective, and that's a substantive. It can be treated like a noun, an evil man. From out of the evil treasure, and that's tuponeru, but it's and the evil man from out of the evil treasure of his heart. There's two cases, two more occurrences of poneros with a definite article, and one is in the accusative case and one is in the genitive case. Brings forth that which is evil. So the accusative case is actually in a it's with a neuter article, a definite neuter article, neuter form in the article that can't be mistaken for a masculine form, and that's how we know that it's talking about something that's evil and not someone that's evil, right? So if you compare Luke 6:45 to this passage, you have to understand that it's asking to be saved from the evil one, from a particular evil person. The same constructs are used four times in Luke 6:45.
If the definite and article is feminine,
on two of those occasions, it has to be referencing an evil man or a good man. There are many other places you could go in scripture to understand that that's referencing a person. It's not just an inanimate evil as a concept or as a thing.
Or a feeling. Evil's just a feeling.
You know what's really frustrating is that this is Matthew, right? The earliest book, pretty much, as they recorded, right? And it's right there, plain and simple. Don't do these things, or if you do these things, like, want to be praised by men. And it's right there, and they don't get it. Right? You would think that these guys who are priests or pastors or so forth, be able to realize.
I'm sorry,
that.
I'm not hearing David or anybody very well.
Oh, I don't know if I'm coming. But you know what I mean? Like it's right there, man.
Yeah, it's super explicit. It's super explicit. Yeah.
Right.
Like Christ says, don't babble on, and Catholics, they have their rosary.
Right. And there are other things too, like for example, the whole giving of donations. I was just talking to my friend. He visited here from Canada last week, and he was telling me, and he's like, baptized into the Orthodox Church and so forth. And he was saying to me that he does not feel comfortable when he gives money because on the envelope, they want your name. They want to know who gave the money, right? And I told him it's your heart and mind, right? But, and this is right here. It's right here in Matthew. You don't take credit for it.
And or I even going back to Matthew 5, where none of the law is done away with, right?
Well,
the Catholic schools.
I'm just saying that
the Catholic schools actually gave school children envelopes 52 envelopes in a box, probably a few more than that, right, in a box. And you were expected every Sunday to go to church and put your donation into that envelope, which had numbers on it, which identifies you.
Yeah.
And they expected you to put it in the envelope so that they could track which of their school children are giving them money every week.
Yeah, and I've been to hospitals. Like, my dad was in the hospital 3 years ago before I moved here, and he had a lung problem, and I was, you know, sitting around because it was there 8 hours a day, and there is like a bunch of plaques, right, on the wall, and who's donated, and it's like all these Jewish names, you know, I gave like 150 grand or whatever, and there was like two out of those 300 that just said unknown, right, and I noticed them because, you know, if there's not much writing on them, then you're going to notice them. And it was the two guys out of like 300-400 that just said unknown. Right? Like, I give $1,000 or whatever. And that's what we should do it.
Even Christ would give people.
Love to trumpet their gifts and their acts of charity, as Christ said here, that they like to make big announcements of pomp and circumstance. They do it all the time.
Yeah, and there's the reward, right? The reward will be other men will see it, and women, and
right,
like, you know, big congratulations. It's like the woman who gave 1 cent, and she gave more. Temple.
Even Christ would heal people and say, "Don't tell anyone I did this for you."
Yeah. And here in verse 2, he says, "Even as the hypocrites do." So don't do it like the hypocrites do, because it's showing their lack of faith that they do it like that, because they're pretending to have faith by making all these displays. But then when you really look at it, they don't have any faith. They're just, because if they did, they wouldn't make the display in the first place. They wouldn't have to have a song and dance about, look at me. Yeah, I believe.
Absolutely.
I think this attitude is exemplified in the anti-racists and their shows of their righteousness, their fake righteousness.
That's a good point, because it's virtue signaling. Virtue signaling is hypocrites, because they pretend to be righteous, but they're not righteous. You know, they think they're more righteous than Christ, but Christ was a racist. Christ ate meat. You know, so they're like vegans who are anti-racist vegans. They think they're more righteous than Christ, but they're just hypocrites.
Yeah, and they're also like some Dutch, I can't remember the sect, where they won't drink wine. But then you say, well, Christ drank wine, right? I mean, he wasn't a drunk. It's just that he drank wine. So it's curious.
Yeah. Them. I've heard about those people, and they try to argue that it wasn't fermented. That's their argument, and they can't prove it. And it's right. Called wine.
Grape juice.
Yeah.
No, I went back and forth with Mark Downey on that for years, and until I got kind of pissed and wrote an article and gave a brief explanation of every single word the Greeks used to describe grapes in the grape-making process. So that he could no longer deny that onus meant fermented wine, because it does. And there's no doubt about that. There's not one doubt about that among scholars of ancient Greek. There's no Greek scholar in any university or in any lexicon that would claim that onus is not fermented, because he'd be a total idiot.
When they were giving drink offerings, did they give wine in the Old Kingdom? Do we know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so why would Yahweh want something unclean if wine's bad?
The Greeks had all sorts of wine words that distinguished different stages in the fermentation process. Because in a world without canning, without pasteurization, and without refrigeration, the fermentation of the grapes was inevitable and it could not be stopped. They had no way to stop it. When you crush grapes, the yeast that causes the grape juice to ferment naturally occurs on the outer skin of the grapes. They didn't know that back then. They just knew that when they crushed the grapes fermented. That they didn't have microscopes and biology to the extent that we have today that we could know these things. 4,000 years ago, they didn't know them. So perhaps somehow the grapes might be able to be washed off. I doubt it, but I don't know. To get rid of all the yeast, I doubt it, but I really don't know.
Yeah, but
the yeast naturally occurs in the skins of the grapes, on the outer skins of the grapes. And when you crush it into a bottle or a vat, the fermentation process essentially begins immediately.
This is another conversation we had with a guy, if you remember on the forum. He was saying that yeast is unclean. Do you recall that? And he was saying that it can be washed off. Do you recall that, Bill, like 6 months ago? Roughly 6 months.
I don't remember, but yeast is not unclean. I said that.
No. That was his contention, right?
Yeah, that's really silly, because what about leavened bread? You know? They eat that all the time.
There's also yeast in the air, constantly.
Yeah, but it's a lot less. But I know what you mean, yeah. But there is, so that guy was saying that yeast is unclean. He was basically taking the Clifton Eberheiser approach to mushrooms.
To mushrooms, yes.
I know.
And Clifton understood my correction on that, but he still wouldn't eat a mushroom.
Yeah.
He went to his grave never having eaten a mushroom.
Yeah, maybe he did before he was CI, right?
I don't know. I really don't know. That's a possibility.
Yeah, so this guy, he was really arguing that yeast had properties that cannot be discounted unless they're washed off. You were saying that, well, nobody washes them off, for one thing. And even if you do, like, how are you really certain that they are washed off, right? I can't believe that you don't remember that. It was like 6 months ago.
I don't remember. That's a lot of water under the bridge. Maybe I'm just getting old.
So Christ says in verse 3, your left hand must not know what your right hand does. And Solomon, in Ecclesiastes, he says that the fool's heart is at his left and the wise man's heart is at his right. And that's sort of prophetic of the left wing, right wing paradigm. And of course, it's the right hand here doing the charity. The left hand doesn't want to do it. The left hand wants to be a communist or something. It's basically a quip, but yeah.
Well, the article is pretty brief, just to get here. It's on, but it's Testament on wine. And I wrote it specifically for Mark Downey.
You know what? Go on, Joe.
Did he change his mind after you wrote that, Bill?
He stopped arguing it after he read it. He just stopped arguing it.
The left hand is sort of a feminine aspect, I think. It's feminine. It's an idiomatic expression, in my opinion. Right? The left and the right.
Well, the left, the word for left in Greek is actually eunomus. Eunomus, which is contracted. It means of good name. But it was a it was an idiom, as bad omens were seen as coming from the left and good omens from the right.
Yeah, like birds flying into the sky.
Yes. And gentlemen, I'm sorry, I have to excuse myself for a second. I'll be right back.
There's also, so this is also, it takes place in other places in the Bible. I can't exactly remember where, but left and the right, like there was a guy, it might have been the book of Judges, who was described as running away from a man who was going to kill him, but he didn't turn to the left or the right. And we're not talking about, I mean, that's not describing a guy moving left or right, that he didn't budge in his opinion. Do you guys recall that?
Well, I think you see that quite a lot in the Old Testament where it says they did not go to the left or the right. They just went in a straight line.
Yeah.
Or that they didn't move away from an ideal, like they didn't budge in an ideal. I think it's just a common expression, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think.
But what I was bringing up was the fact that Solomon says a fool's at the left and a wise man's at the right, and that's sort of prophetic of like left wing, right wing. And you do see a few times in the Bible where left is negative and right is positive, sort of like when Christ, he divides the sheep and the goats are on the left and the sheep are on the right.
Yeah.
I got a quick question for you. Just digressing a little bit. I forgot which president it was that went to the one of these Arab countries. And I think it was Nixon. And when he was exiting the plane, he waved to the people and he used the left hand. And that is an extreme insult to the Arab people, because that's the hand that they normally wipe their rear in. And he knew that as he was descending the plane. And I always thought that was rather interesting.
That's funny.
Well, that is funny, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck those Arabs.
I agree.
Well, do you want to read Treasures in Heaven, Jackson?
I don't think we did fasting. I don't think we did 16 to 18.
No, I stopped right at 13.
Okay.
Yeah, stopped at 13.
Do you want me to resume?
Sure.
Verse 14. If you would remit for men their transgressions, your heavenly Father shall also remit for you. But if you should not remit for men's transgressions, neither shall your Father remit your transgressions. And when you should fast, do not be like the sullen-faced hypocrites, for they obscure their faces that they may appear to be fasting to men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you fasting and anoint your head and wash your face, that you should not appear to be fasting to men, but to your Father whom is... Sorry. I lost my place. Truly I say to you, they have their reward, but you fasting, anoint your head and wash your face, that you should not appear to be fasting to men, but to your Father whom is in secret. And avoid your Father who seeing shall repay you in secret. Do not store up for your treasures upon the earth, where moth and corrosion obliterate, and where thieves dig through and steal. But store up your treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor corrosion obliterate, and where thieves do not dig through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there also shall be your heart. The lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore your eye should be sincere. Your whole body shall be bright. But if your eye should be evil, your whole body shall be dark. Then if the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one is able to serve two masters. For either he would hate the one and would love the other, or he would endure the one and despise the other. You are not able to serve Yahweh and riches. For this reason, I say to you, do not care for your life what you should eat or what you should drink, nor for your body what you should wear. Is life nothing more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of heaven. that they do not sow, nor harvest, nor gather into storehouses, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than them? Who caring from among you is able to add one cubit to his stature? And what do you care about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They do not toil nor spin yarn. But I say to you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was clothed as one of these. Now, if the grass of the field exists today and tomorrow, it is cast into a furnace. Yahweh clothes thusly. How much more you, you of little faith? Therefore, you should not have care, saying, what should we eat, or what should we drink, or what should we wear? For all these things the heathen seek after. Indeed, your heavenly Father knows that you have need of all these things. But you seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, you should not have care for tomorrow shall care for itself. Sufficient for the days are its vices. End of chapter 6.
Joe, I think I was just going to say, Joe, I think you said in the chat recently that, you know, when you follow Yahweh, you just have so much joy, and it's genuine joy and happiness. And that just reminded me of that reading this. And when you follow Yahweh, you also have so much comfort. Life is so much more easy. You don't have to worry about everything every day. You have that comfort and that stability. So it just made me think of what you said in the chat. Like, it just brings you so much joy.
You don't need to worry about the fear porn and all this crap either.
Yeah.
Because you believe in God and that he'll protect you and things. But this verse 33 where it says, sorry, Jerrell.
It all comes through faith.
Yeah.
If we have the faith, yeah, we'll have these things.
Yeah. In our verse.
If we spend our life in worry and chasing fear porn, we're actually failing ourselves, our kinsmen, our God. We're just failing. That's why I'm not really big at all on fear porn and Christogenia. That's why I don't talk about current events that much, because speaking about current events is really all fear porn, because everything's fucked up. So just let it be fucked up. Just let it go on. Let the world disintegrate. I'd rather see it incinerate, but let it disintegrate and let it disintegrate around us, and we should not have a care for it.
Yep. The fallen angels fucked it up at the beginning. So if you're going to keep whining about that all day, I think you should spend more time reading the Bible, to be honest, rather than reading fear porn all day. That's my thoughts on it. You know, read the Bible.
When I do read fear porn, it's just for entertainment, for real. But I very rarely get caught up in any sort of fear porn. When I look at the news, it's just for entertainment, because I need to be entertained for 20 minutes. So I go see some videos and laugh at some niggers killing each other and move on with my day.
And Chink being pulled into the machinery at a factory, because that's how they do it in China.
Yeah.
Then they just throw him out and they hire another one.
It's crazy, right? They don't care. But all of that actually only it gives material reality to what we believe. So that's fine. I mean, it's comforting to see that. But we shouldn't worry about it. We shouldn't worry about anything. Perfect love has no fear.
Yeah.
You know, in verse 29, it's actually saying that.
Foy Dog, can you turn off your mic?
Hold on.
Thanks, Noel. So, yeah, like, no matter what you wear, it's not going to be better than what I provided for the earth, right? So he's seeing the lilies of the field look better than what Solomon wore. And Solomon was probably wearing the best stuff around, right?
Yeah, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Let's kind of start at the beginning. I don't know if we covered the Lord's Prayer here to sufficiently that things that the whole concept of Christianity, the whole concept is to believe that Yahweh is going to keep his promises, which he made in the Old Testament, and that ultimately things will be on earth as they already are in heaven. We're not all going to be raptured up to heaven because his kingdom's going to be established here on earth, and we need to be here on earth. We would rather be here seeking to establish his kingdom. And this Sermon on the Mount is basically the instructions how to establish his kingdom. Because if you're following his will, and if you're obedient to him and treating your brethren as he wants you to treat your brethren, he will protect you, and his kingdom will materialize on earth. It's real simple. These are the instructions to life right here.
And these are the blueprints of eternity.
Right.
And he will deliver us from the devices of the evil one. So don't spend, you know, obsess over what the Jews are doing.
No.
Exactly. Even if it's entertaining. So here in verse 14, once again, and this is like the second time in this chapter, maybe the third, to forgive men, remit men their transgressions, that's just a parallelism for where he had said in verse 39 that if someone slaps you on the cheek, to turn the other cheek.
Bill, if you're going to remit a man his transgressions, wouldn't he also have to be under the law?
Yes.
I mean, you can't sin against a bastard, can you? So
no. No, this is speaking to his people for, by, and about his people. He's speaking about your personal enemies. He's not speaking about his enemies. They're on the outside. That they should be isolated from us.
They're the evil one, which he mentions.
Yeah, definitely. You're not supposed to like remit. They don't have these transgressions. They're not under the law. They're the evil one, for sure. They're outside that relationship. They're outside the relationship of brotherly love. So we've got the relationship of brotherly love versus the enemy. Two different paradigms. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, you know, this fasting, that this concept of fasting, if you read the law in the Old Testament, you fast so that you could do without, so that you can have something to give with or to give to or to share with another. So you might fast on a Thursday or Friday so that you could have a big meal with a brother on a Sunday. That's just an example. It's you fast so that you could have something for later or give it to someone else so that they can have it because maybe they don't have anything. So you fast for a reason. You don't just fast for to be self-righteous. You don't just fast to say, hey, look at me, I'm fasting, or hey, I fasted, I'm special. You fast, it's making a sacrifice so that you have to give to another.
And that's a very big thing in the Catholic churches, like the Orthodox Catholic Church. It's like if you fast, you do the 40-day thing, which is not a real fast. It's like you can eat bread and, I don't know, a bunch of other stuff, just no red meat. And then after the 40 days, you're like in the front of the line at the church. And everybody like looks at you like you're a good guy. But, you know, I was thinking, so Christ, everything he did was an example to us of how to live. And he did a fast for 40 days, right? Out in the wilderness?
Yes.
And so did Moses and others. So it's something that we should, I think, aspire to.
Yeah. Right.
Like even if it's 5 days or whatever, 3 days, I think it's something we can aspire
I've actually,
to.
The last 5 years I've fasted for more than 5 days twice.
You feel better, right? I felt better. But like I've done it, I think 3 days.
It was because of the bad reflux I was having, right?
Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
Luke does mention. I didn't have to fast, but I decided to fast, but it was because of my health. It wasn't because I'm pious.
Yeah, but you feel better afterwards, right?
Yeah.
I really do. So, I feel better. I did feel better.
Sabio, you're saying you're making a sacrifice. You're fasting for a purpose, just like it says in the Old Testament. Yahweh says the type of Sabbath he wants. He wants you to make sacrifices for your brother on the Sabbath, right? Well, right. In the next verse, in verse 19, it says, do not store up for you treasure upon the earth, but store up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Well, when you make a sacrifice for your brother, that's storing up for yourself treasure in heaven, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And that really shows you, you know, Bill was talking about it earlier, how everything here just flows so smoothly from one point to the next. Ever since Bill said that, I've really been noticing it, like everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all, connected. But when we get to Matthew chapter 13, the parables, they're all interconnected in meaning. Here, all of these instructions to the children of Israel or to his group of disciples are for them and for how they should interact and build a community together with each other. It's not for outsiders. It's for people that were under law and that understand the gospel of Christ.
Right. And then you get to the next verse, Bill, and it's for where your treasure is, there also shall be your heart. That's having a heart for God and having a heart for your people.
Right. It's not a regular heart like we would think in modern terms. Yeah.
That's where your mind is.
Having a heart for something is to be focused on it. It's not to desire it lustfully. It's to be focused on it, to work towards that objective.
The heart basically means the mind. I mean, the Bible says Yahweh knows the reasoning of the heart. Yes. He just knows your thoughts.
That's what it's talking about, Noble, where it says, if your eye should be evil, like it's talking about your mind, like you're at the focus of your mind. No one's able to serve two masters. And then you go down to verse 33 and it says, but you first seek the kingdom and his righteousness and all these things shall be added to you. So that's exactly... You know how you're saying it flows, Noble? Well, that's exactly what he's saying up here. You cross-reference verse 33 to let your eye be single, you know, for where your treasure is, there also shall be your heart. All these things are interconnected. So you want to, he's basically telling you, put your heart on the kingdom, put your heart on your king and his righteousness. Seek those things and your whole body shall be as light and you shall have treasure in heaven.
Yeah, you're right. Verse 21 and verse 33 are basically parallelisms.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Did I screw up again, Joe? I don't have single there.
But if your eye should be... Well, I'm remembering the King James. I'm reading it into your translation, aren't I? Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I'm just teasing you.
By the way, everything Joe just said
sincere.
Is solidified by verse 34.
Yes.
Incredible.
I mean, every time I've ever worried about tomorrow, then, if I just say, okay, whatever is going to happen is going to happen. Tomorrow was often better. But when I try to control it, it doesn't work.
You know, God doesn't want us to live that way.
Yeah.
He doesn't want us to just walk around suffering all the time because we're worrying about things we can't control. We should just understand that He has the wheel. He has the wheel and we just trust.
I go through that all the time with certain of my loved ones. Don't worry about things you can't control. It's absolute folly to worry about things you can't control.
Yeah, even ourselves, we can't control to some degree, a great degree. It's difficult. If there's one thing we can control, it might be ourselves, but even that's difficult. But controlling other people, work.
It's sort of like what we were talking about last week. We got to bring every thought into captivity before Christ, because when we do that, it becomes easier. It becomes easier to just sit back and trust.
That was really edifying for me when Bill was talking about that.
Oh, me too. I told my wife about it, actually. I was telling her, I was like, you got to listen to the Bible study we had because Yeah, it really, yeah, it was really a find for me too, Joe.
Every thought in the captivity.
Yeah.
All right, I'll let Bill go on with the next verses.
Second Corinthians 10.
I don't know if we have any next verses now, do we?
Oh, well, I thought you were continuing.
I'm sorry.
I thought I might have impeded you because you're continuing through them all, and I might have...
No, I mean, y'all did fine. I don't have to have all a word for everything. Y'all did fine. I don't... You're not able to serve Yahweh in riches or God in mammon. I screwed up again. I'm sorry. No. That it is all an interconnected thread. Right from the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, right to the end, it's all interconnected. It all relies on the whole fabric in order to really make sense and in order to really be understood. You can't take one verse out of here like the pagans do that David was talking about, that they condemn Christianity by taking one verse and separating it from everything else and beating us over the head with it. You can't do that. That's not a correct way to interpret any of this.
Yeah, that's so weak. Taking one verse and like beat it. Yeah. They're antichrist. Why do you hate Christ, bro? Is what I'd say. Why do you hate Jesus?
Well, the perfect man, according to this, is the man that loves his brother, that forgives his brother's trespasses, that is willing to do things for a brother, to do without his own victuals so that a brother can eat, and that doesn't worry about how he's going to feed himself tomorrow.
If you're too... like concerned about your own life, you're not going to make sacrifices for your brother. That's why he says here, dude, right. It's all interlinked, like you're saying, Bill. Do not care for your life. Like he says that at verse 25 and then 34, he's saying, do not have care for tomorrow. Like if you're always worried about your own life and what you can get and how your life's going, you're not going to make any sacrifices for your brother.
Right.
You're not going to be seeking the kingdom.
You're more worried about the return on your IRA or your stocks that you've invested in and worldly concerns like that, and you're going to lose all that.
And the paradox is that if you didn't care about all that, God would dress you like how he's dressed one of the lilies of the field or how he dressed Solomon. You know, right. If you stopped caring about all that and let God dress you,
God will even use miracles like Elijah. He was in the wilderness and he was hungry and ravens brought him bread. I don't think Elijah was expecting that, but Yahweh made it happen.
But ravens are black.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe they stole the bread, Bill. Maybe they stole it. I don't know.
I think Yahweh, as
I
well.
No bread for this nigger? Why don't you send a dove?
Well, I'm just thinking of the King James. I don't know what it is in Hebrew. Ravens. I don't know.
They're smart.
They are smart, aren't they?
They are very smart. Crows too.
I think like being clothed like Solomon doesn't necessarily mean like having all the riches of this world. It would be clothed according to how God wants you to be clothed. And I think that would be more content. You'd be more content being clothed as God wants you to be clothed rather than wearing all the finest linen that this world can offer you, like Gucci. I can't think of any fashion brands other than, you know, Gucci, like why would you want that stuff? Or people who have that stuff are empty inside because they don't have God. They're still angry. They might have a Ferrari, but they're still terrible people. Yeah, but then if you're clothed by God, you can have the joy, like Noble was talking about, the joy and the peace, and be clothed by God. That's what we want.
Absolutely. But the thing is, Joe, simple. I mean, I'm sure you understand this, is that they think that they're becoming closer to God by buying those things.
I think what's worse is if they have those things, and if they lost them, that would be the end of the world for them. I mean, like, it should be like, who cares? Life will go on. It's fine. It doesn't matter if you lose everything you have. You'll be okay. And that is what's important. So they're putting more worth on the watch or the phone or the car or whatever than God. That's the bottom line. So it's fine to have nice things. I don't see a problem with that. It's whether you put your worth on those things that's the end of the world if you lose them.
I think it's also like loving your brethren, because we were talking about fasting and how if you fast, you have more food to give to your brethren. Well, if you buy a Gucci jacket and you spend $1,000 on that, that's $1,000 less dollars you have to help your brethren. But you could have bought a $30 jacket and then you would have much more. So I think it's also like a priority too, because nobody needs a Gucci jacket. Like in the end, nobody needs that. I don't even know if Gucci, they make jackets. I don't know. But in the end, you don't need designer clothing. You don't. No one needs it.
Right. Totally agree.
Can I read Psalm 102? They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment, like clothing. You will change them and they will be discarded, but you remain the same and your years will never end.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with having nice things, but the point of fasting is just to make some self-sacrifice so that you could help others. And that doesn't preclude you from having a Lincoln Navigator or something like that, right? It really doesn't. But if you see a brother in need, you look at your wallet and you have $300 and you're like, well, I was going to take this $100 and invest it in the stock market this week. Well, you're better off giving it to the brother in need. That's my example. That's probably a fair example that we do confront at least once or twice in our lives, probably more often than that, and we don't realize it.
You know, when I had the antique shop, I had a 22-room home in Shreveport full of antiques, and I collected everything, and it meant the world and all to me. Well, Yahweh got my attention.
Yeah.
And he took all of that away from me. And you know, I was happier afterwards than I was when I had everything.
Right. That's a wonderful testimony, Gerald.
Yeah, that's great.
22 rooms, Gerald.
Yeah, and they all had to be cleaned.
You could have found the Eames living in about 18 of them. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
You know, the entire Sermon on the Mount really shows what Christ meant when he said that loving God and loving brethren, the entire law hangs on that.
Right.
The whole law. It's all about that. It's never about anything arbitrary. Like even the feasts, right? In the waning years of the old kingdom, the Israelites were treating the feasts as an opportunity for indulgence.
Yep.
But then they weren't using the feast to feed their poor brethren, because the feast was for everybody. The idea was that the whole nation would come together and even the poor would be able to feast on that day. But they were just using it for indulgence. They completely missed the point. The point is about loving your brethren.
But even Paul was basically upbraiding the Corinthians for the same thing. They were using the Sabbath days as a time to indulge themselves while other people in the assembly were going hungry.
Oh, right. Yeah,
and Paul said, don't you have homes to eat in?
Yeah.
Wow. On the Sabbath day, you should live like we're already in the kingdom.
Right. We should live every day like we're already in the kingdom. And then the kingdom would materialize.
It would.
Yeah, that's another reason you shouldn't spend all your time worrying about what the Jews are doing, because they're nothing. They shouldn't even exist. You should be living in a reality where you barely notice them.
Yeah.
You know, because you're living like you're in the kingdom. They're not going to be in the kingdom, so I'm just going to pretend like, you know, not pretend, but just minimize their role in my life. And
yeah, because we're always fixated on, you know, whether or not this fucking asshole, this Jew or whatever, is going to do something and it's going to be upsetting to me. But really, we shouldn't. We fall into that trap. Because, you know, ultimately, like you said, we're going to live forever. And that's one thing that I remember from you saying in your podcast, Bill, I don't know how many years ago it was. It's just, you're going to live forever. I'm going to live forever.
Right.
Yeah, and he won't. So, you know, but it's not right in front of your face, right? It's not something that you often think about.
You know, it's all a matter of personal perspective. I don't know what... I know what y'all do when you're talking to me in the chat or when we're here, but I don't know what you're really doing in between chatting or whatever. It's personal perspective. I don't sit around worrying about what Jews are doing. I take occasions to mock them at things they've done, like with the Jewish tunnel bullshit, right? I'm just mocking Jews because they deserve to be mocked, but I'm not worried about their next tunnel or the next person they rape or whatever. I don't really give a damn. I just look for occasions to mock them and get in their faces a little bit and hope that other white people see that and something wakes them up. So I only use those as opportunities, but otherwise I'm focused on what I have to do. I don't care about what Jews have to do or what they're going to do.
You know, I try to get people to be able to identify who the Jews are because the church is teaching them Christ as a Jew.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's like Clifton used to say, we have to identify the enemy as a faithful watchman.
Exactly.
So I just mock them, but I really don't worry about what they're doing.
It sort of reminds me of... Go ahead, Gerald.
I look at it like the more that the Jews do and get away with, the closer Christ is to coming and setting his kingdom up.
Amen.
Yeah. That's why we sort of rejoice. As things get worse, we rejoice. This whole conversation sort of reminded me of how Yahweh, he calls things not existing as existing because he knew they would exist in the future. Well, we know Jews won't exist in the future, so we can call things existing as not existing.
Good point.
They're already dead. Yeah, their fate is sealed. The axe is already laid to the root of their trees. They're done.
Yeah. You guys want
to I won't miss them at all when they finally go to hell.
You guys want to continue or?
No, we're good.
You want to cut it?
Yes, sir.